The Recipes for Life podcast is a conversation about my favorite ingredients for a healthy human experience. We take an informed look at topics that include nutritional and emotional well-being, as well as expanded consciousness. This podcast is presented by the Pete Evans Healthy Everyday range of super blends, including collagen super blends, bone broth super blends, and check out our new all grass-fed, grass-finished beef liver capsules. And there's more to come. You can find out more at gelatinaustralia.com. That's www.gelatinaustralia.com. Diane Capaldi, or V, or the Paleo Boss Lady, is one of, if not the most healed from secondary progressive MS that we know of in the world. All through diet and lifestyle changes, the food piece was her missing link to kicking the bastard known as MS to the curb. This boss has dedicated herself and her life to building a grassroots movement of change and sold all of her life possessions. She now lives with complete strangers, offering tools of empowerment to help them tap into their miracle status all over the USA. Individuals simply ask V to live with them, and she says yes, offering all of her services for free or donation, only in an effort to build a grassroots movement of consciousness. No longer does she live a fear-driven life or a life defined by MS. This boss is in control with many tools that support her journey. All of the tools in her bag of tricks are 100% accessible to everyone, which makes this the biggest freaking bam of all. To find out more about V, visit paleobosslady.com. That's paleobosslady.com. V, thank you so much for being a part of our podcast. And you're also known as another name, the Paleo Boss Lady. And for anyone that doesn't know your story, which I think is one of the most remarkable stories, and it's continuing, I'd love for you to be able to recap and take us through, I guess, through the timeline of this, of who you are, because you are a shining light in this world of negativity, because you are just full of positiveness. So let's talk about V.
Well, thank you so much for asking me to be on, and I'd be happy to share my story. And I appreciate the reference to positivity, because I do live a very joyful life, and I wake up every day with extreme gratitude. And it wasn't always that way, I have to admit. At the age of 23 years old, I was a respiratory therapist at the time, and I received the hepatitis vaccine because I have, I worked in a hospital, and the day after I got the vaccine, I woke up and started having loss of feeling on my body, and it progressed very quickly to, the whole left side of my body. And I also had trouble walking. I had, my face was very distorted, and there was movements that I couldn't feel but were happening and other people could see. Went to the doctor, and at that time, the first thing the doctor said is, "Can you stand up and lift one leg?" And I lifted the one leg, and I fell flat on my face. And being someone who was in the field of medicine at the time, I knew something was seriously wrong with me. They sent me right to a neurologist. And at that time, they didn't have MRIs. They had CAT scans. And they did a CAT scan of me, and the diagnosis came back that I had an inoperable brain tumor. Now, the sad truth is, Pete, is that I was married 6 weeks to my high school sweetheart when this happened. So I went from the greatest joy to devastation. They told me that I had a brain tumor on my brain stem and that it wouldn't be operable. And there really wasn't much hope at that point. Luckily, because I did work in the healthcare field, and I actually worked in burn care at the time, the head of the burn center pulled me aside and he was like, I don't see this. Like, I think that they're completely wrong and you need to go see as many doctors as you can. So he made a couple phone calls for me, and I was lucky enough to get to see a neurologist who did have access to an MRI, which was very new technology then. And, you know, the problem was it was so new, insurance didn't cover it. It was going to cost a lot of money. And I had to sort of navigate all that to be able to get this new test. And it took a little while. And once I got the test, the neurologist called back and said that he didn't believe it was a brain tumor and that he wanted to do a spinal tap because he thought potentially it was MS. And, you know, by the grace of God, I was my death sentence went to a life sentence and I was diagnosed with MS. And the minute that I was diagnosed, the National MS Society had an office in my doctor's office and I was introduced to the National MS Society. I was just very young at that time and started working with community and got involved with, there weren't disease modifying drugs at that time. So I volunteered to be one of the test patients for the FDA and let them, you know, I didn't know if they were injecting placebo or the drug, but I signed up to do everything. I grew to eventually be on a division of the board of directors of the National MS Society. I was the largest fundraiser in the state of Pennsylvania and Delaware. And was a guest lecturer for the MS Society, touring around telling people take the drugs. And I looked like I was the poster child for the MS Society. And the type A overachiever in me did everything the doctors told me. I took the drugs. I did the PT. I worked out every day. I had a positive attitude. And I'm not going to lie, it still took me down. I mean, MS literally took me down to the point where I lost bilateral use of both of my hands. I had no feeling on the left side of my body. I started having trouble swallowing, which is a lot of us die from that because we choke. I had involuntary limb jumping, so I lost the ability to drive. Two marriages destroyed over MS. And my life became, I lost the ability to manage body temperature. And it became a living nightmare. I mean, I couldn't beat this thing as hard as I tried. And I eventually became legally disabled and found myself completely alone. And, you know, as luck would have it, Pete, in that time from when I was diagnosed until MS disabled me, I was fortunate to build technology companies and ended up having a substantial nest egg. And I, even though my health was failing, you know, I had several million dollars in the bank and decided to move to California because my body temperature issues were so severe that living on the East Coast, I became a prisoner in my house. I couldn't really go out in the heat and I couldn't really go out in the cold, and moved to Venice Beach, California, where the temperature is between 55 and 75. And it kind of seemed like the smartest thing I could have done. I started doing really well. I became a certified yoga instructor. I became a spinning instructor. I made friends easily. I thought I'm the smartest human being alive. Until in typical MS fashion, one day I woke up and it was even worse than before. It got to the point where to use my hands to dress myself, feed myself, and use the ladies' room was about all I could do. I required full-time help. I had to have live-in help. And that $2.5 million in America, our healthcare system is broken. And if you have a disease, especially MS, over 88% of people with MS are bankrupt. In the United States, I blew through every dollar that I had and was facing homelessness, institutionalization. And to be quite honest, I really considered taking my own life. I had no quality of life. And the only thing really keeping me alive was I have a daughter who I love and adore, and my son rises and sets with being a parent. But I did everything the doctors told me. I took all the drugs, which the one disease modifying drug in America I took for 19 years, I injected with Betaseron. That alone cost me $500,000. And in the United States of America, if you have a disabling disease, you're only allowed to have 8 physical therapy appointments a year. And I need a physical therapy 3 days a week just to be able to go to the ladies' room. So I used all my own money for that. And then acupuncture, I needed acupuncture to be able to know that I had to go to the ladies' room. I had to pay for my own full-time help. I had to pay for the people that lived with me. I had to use all of my own funds. And when I decided that, when life decided, I had only about 3 years left of income, of money, before I was going to go broke, I decided to this is going to sound freaky, but I decided to go to this festival in the desert in Nevada called Burning Man, which is a, it's like an arts festival, and it's a no consumer driven festival. But the reason why I wanted to go there was, well, two reasons. One is no consumerism. So you can't buy or sell anything. It's a no judgment event. And they built a temple. So I wanted to go to the temple every day, really, because I wanted to see if I should take my own life is the main reason why I went to the temple every day. And by the fourth day of just being in the temple and not even thinking, just trying to be and hoping life would tell me or it give me some direction, it was like a brick hit my forehead. I actually thought maybe the way I live my life is the problem. Like maybe I am toxic and that's why MS is doing this. So when I came home from Burning Man, I decided I was going to lock myself in the house for a year and start questioning everything. Now, prior to this, I had already been a yoga instructor and moving my body religiously. I had already been studying Buddhism and doing silent meditative retreats. So I had a tremendous amount of spirituality. I had a tremendous amount of movement. I mean, I've been moving my body since I was 18 years old. So those things were already in place, but consciousness of life was not. And this was in September of 2011. And I just really cut myself off from everyone. So if people text me or reached out to me or emailed me, I just wouldn't respond. I didn't tell anyone or say anything to anyone. I just retreated. And as luck would have it, during that retreat, I was addicted to Dr. Google, and I kept, at that time I couldn't use my hands, so I used my voice to activate the computer. So I was one night just yelling into the computer. I was like, food, diet, lifestyle, MS. And the day that Dr. Terry Walls, who I know you've had on, her Minding Your Mitochondria TEDx came up, and I remember it as clear as day. I watched it and I thought, what? This can't be true. Like, am I being punked? Like, is this real? This woman is telling me that she was in this tilt reclining wheelchair and now she's like standing there and talking and saying that it's food, that she did this with food. So I just started doing exactly what Dr. Wells said. I mean, at that time, she didn't have a website. She didn't have a Facebook page. She had nothing other than the TEDx. And I just started doing exactly what she said, which was eating a modified form of paleo, which involves 9 cups of fruits and vegetables, 3 cups of leafy greens, 3 cups of sulfur rich, 3 cups of colors. And I immediately started doing what she said. And that was the missing piece to my puzzle. And today, I've been following the Wells Protocol since January 1st, 2012 is my official date, but I really started in November when I saw it in 2011. And as of today, I am, as far as we know, the most healed person in the world who has secondary progressive MS, because I do not take any drugs and I do not see any doctors and I do not spend $1 on healthcare costs other than insurance. I am completely self-empowered and I manage and have reversed every symptom of MS that has been delivered to me, and my healthcare costs are zero. And I don't even see physical therapists. Like, I see no one. I totally do everything all by myself.
That is absolutely amazing. Now, I do have a question for you.
Okay.
Reading your bio and about you, you talk about that you went through this process, and there's one line that really sticks out for me. You say that the autopilot of life was officially ending and you were waking the fuck up. So yeah. The thought that I have is, why do you think you, as V, or the Paleo Boss Lady, Diane, whatever name you choose to be called, has gone through this experience and is still going through this experience? If you're expanding your consciousness and you're working out who you really are, obviously you must have thought about this or have a realization as to why this has happened to you. why this is, all of these events in your life has led you to being what you're doing now.
Yes. The autopilot of life is what I really believe is the reason why MS was able to basically be in the driver's seat of my life. I'm 100% Italian. That's why I'm Paleo Boss Lady, because I'm from Philadelphia. I'm Italian and I was born under the sign of Taurus, so I'm bossy. And also, you know, I love my culture and I love the community where I was raised. I mean, I'm still friends with every single person I grew up with. I mean, I love everything about, from childhood on. But a big part of that for me was just doing what I was told as a woman, as a daughter, as an Italian female, as someone in the neighborhood. I mean, I followed the rules, let's say. And when I decided to lock myself in the house, I realized, you know, a perfect example is a rule that we all follow is, you know, most people eat breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And most people eat certain foods for breakfast and certain foods for lunch and certain foods for dinner. And in fact, if you eat breakfast foods for dinner, you say, I'm having breakfast for dinner, which, you know, just getting conscious about things like that really changed the game for me. You know, getting conscious about food through the Walls Protocol was one thing, but getting conscious about my life and who I was. And I used to, simple things, like I used to always say, my MS, you know, realizing that that's like, if someone is an addict and says, I'm an addict, just like saying my MS, like there's a whole bunch of stuff that is sort of attached to that, that just comes along with those words, where I learned how to change my narrative and say, I struggle with MS. So I could now look at it objectively and start to break down the things that I struggled with. And, you know, that I was raised where you go to a doctor and a doctor tells you something and you just do whatever they say. And I never heard my parents question a doctor about a drug or a treatment or a test. And I, you know, in the autopilot of life, when that stopped, I had to start questioning. You know, I was still in traditional healthcare at that time. And, you know, I started questioning the doctors, like, well, I don't want to take, because I was on 14 medications plus injecting with interferon. And my out-of-pocket healthcare costs were over $37,000 a year. That's not counting full-time help. That's just counting drugs and, deductibles, you know, expenses, studies, things like that. And I started questioning, you know, everything. Why? I mean, even simple things like, I always woke up with an alarm clock and it always scared the bejesus out of me. And so I woke up very fight or flight every day. And I don't wake up. I don't even use an alarm anymore. I mean, if you talk to my daughter and people that have known me, there's nothing about my life that has not changed. I mean, even so much that I left my beloved Philadelphia and everyone I knew and moved to California to try and save myself. And even, you know, the doctors, when I was first diagnosed, they gave me Valium, and my mom was a prescription drug addict. And I said no to Valium and started using essential oils. So really, I started questioning and doing alternative stuff in the beginning, but I had to literally lock myself in the house and question everything from what I ate, who I hung out with, the hours I went to bed, my workouts. I worked out toxic because I was always trying to beat MS out of my body. I mean, I would go to the gym. The gym was off my bedroom. I would wake up, go to my gym with the mantra that MS, I'm going to win. And you're no match for me. Well, I had to learn that I had to embrace MS. I mean, Pete, the God's honest truth is if the heavens opened up tomorrow and said, okay, V, pick your life, whatever you want, I would want MS. I would want exactly the same life, because it has given me such joy, and because I am totally awake and conscious and there is no autopilot. I'm aware of everything I do, everything I say, the clothes I put on my body. I mean, I'm a minimalist. I am voluntarily homeless. I only have 70 possessions. I only wear 3 colors. I have more than enough. I don't want for anything. I don't need anything. I, by American standards, I live at poverty. All the people that are my age that I know, their home is paid off. They have grandkids. They're getting ready to retire. And like, I don't fit into that mold at all. Like, I actually live 100% the opposite, but these are all conscious choices. Like, the fact that I don't have a home is a conscious choice. And I think a lot of people don't understand that, but my autopilot is completely gone. And I am conscious to the point that what time I go to bed, what I eat, when I wake up, how I move my body. I mean, when I wake up in the morning, the first thing I do is I dance. When I'm making my bulletproof coffee or my fat coffee, I just dance. And why I'm dancing is A, to get myself happy, but to hear what my body has to tell me. And then I know what the day is going to hold based on dancing. And, you know, today I had to ball roll, do some self myofascial release for about an hour and a half before I could get on the yoga mat. And I did yoga on the beach to the sunrise. And then I took a 3-mile walk along the beach later that day. And, you know, and tonight at sunset, I'll be hula hooping. Well, my body told me all that this morning at 4 a.m., which is what time I wake up. Which most people were like, what? And I'm like, yeah, because my hips weren't tight and my shoulders weren't tight, but my feet were tight and my calves were tight and my hands were tight, my limbs were, you know, and that means that my fascia needed to be worked on before I would be able to move effectively on the yoga mat. Where before I would work out Monday, Wednesday, Friday, I did an hour spin, an hour yoga. On the weekends, I did double spin, an hour, like, my workouts were based on the day of the week, nothing to do with my body. You see what I'm saying?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I would do those like squat challenges where for a month and Monday you do 50 and I would just, even though my body hurt, I would still do it because I was like, I'm going to beat you, MS. And then I would be a cripple for 3 days, but I'd still push through it. I mean, now I live in harmony with my body and we coexist together and we communicate. And that is very powerful.
Well, let's talk about fear, because it doesn't seem like you did I just hear that?
Yeah.
Because it's a topic that I want to bring into the podcast more and more. Obviously, with the opposite side of it being love, or unconditional love, if we want to really define it. But it seems like you have faced and embraced quite a few of your fears through this experience of your life. So let's delve a little bit deeper into fear and what it means to you and what it did used to mean to you. And some of that expression that you can share with the listeners, please.
It's interesting because fear drove my life for a long time. And as any rational person would do that has no use of their hands and can't drive and can't carry and can't move their head or anything like that, I decided to go back to school and get a BA and a master's in psychology. I mean, I know it sounds insane, but believe it or not, I did. And when I was in my BA program, I started studying narrative therapy, which is actually out of New Zealand. It's a postmodern form of psychotherapy. And our instructor at the time would always have these sort of mock therapy sessions. And the fear inside of me was so strong at this point that when I walked into class that night, I said to my teacher's name was Charlie. I said to Charlie, can I do the mock therapy session today? And he said, sure, V. So at the beginning of the class, he said, V has volunteered to do the mock therapy session. So we're going to start off with that. And the therapy session didn't start even a minute before Charlie realized that this was going to be a real therapy session, because I was crippled by fear at this point. Getting out of bed, going to school, getting dressed, I almost couldn't do any of it because I was just so afraid, because at this time I couldn't trust my body at all. I didn't know if when I stood, I was going to fall. I didn't know if when I sat down to use the ladies' room, were my hands going to be able to wipe myself? I mean, literally, was I going to be able to put clothes on? Was I going to be able to walk to the bus stop? Was I going to be able to swallow, or was I going to choke? I mean, everything was there. I was just full of fear. And I had at this time recently taken a very bad fall, and I was really struggling and my body was literally almost like The Exorcist. I mean, it was just sort of jumping all the time. And Charlie said, okay, so what would you like to talk about in this therapy session? And I said, I want to talk about fear. And he said, okay, what do you want to talk about with fear? And I just said, fear controls my life. And I want to like kill myself. It's just, that's where I am. And he looked at me and he said, well, what did you have before? Has fear always been there? And I was like, no. And he said, well, what did you have before fear? And I got to tell you, Pete, I like couldn't even remember. All I knew was that fear was just everything at that point. Like I didn't even know that I didn't have fear until he asked me that there was a time in my life I didn't have fear. And then I was like, well, what did I have before fear? And it took me a while to answer. And I was like, I had balls. And he said, well, where are your balls? And I was like, I forgot I had balls. I don't even know. And he was like, Charlie was like, well, how about if fear and balls have a conversation? And it was at that moment that I realized that it's like fear was so strong in me that I forgot who I was, what I was. I forgot everything. All I knew was that fear was guiding and MS was winning because fear was guiding. And that was a huge wake-up call to me that I had to do everything in my power to take fear out of the driver's seat and put myself back into the driver's seat. And that was that mock therapy session. The whole class was crying. The instructor was crying. I mean, everyone was moved by this because they saw in real time that I was being reminded that there was more to me than fear. But I can tell you that when you have disease, autoimmune, cancer, psychological, physical issues, it's really easy to have fear be in the driver's seat. And I definitely had fear in the driver's seat. And that was, that mock therapy session was my wake-up call that I needed to change that. And that happened when I was sort of locked in the house that year. You know, I wasn't socializing. I was going to school because I was in school, but I wasn't going out. I wasn't, you know, hanging out. And I had to work really long and hard. I mean, for me, it involved going to psychotherapy several times a week and, you know, looking fear in the face. And I can tell you that I am now, at this point, I believe I am 100% fearless, because the thing that I feared the most since I found out I had MS was, I'm sorry, I get emotional, was I always feared being homeless, because MS, you know, takes, in America, and when you have MS, you're bankrupt. And most people with MS become addicted to drugs. So you're not only addicted to drugs, but you're bankrupt. And we're the second longest and youngest population in institutions in America. So I just always believed that I was going to, because I didn't want to be in an institution, I just thought I would make myself homeless. And I decided 2 years ago that I was just going to face fear in the right in the face. And I made myself homeless. So I am voluntarily homeless because I no longer wanted to fear being homeless anymore. So that's why I think I'm fearless. And I couldn't drive for a really long time because I couldn't use my hands. And I not only decided to make myself voluntarily homeless, but I decided that I was going to drive all over America. So I was basically going to live out of my car, which were two of my biggest fears. And, you know, when I told my daughter I was going to do this, she was like, Mom, I think you're crazy, but I think this is like, I think your whole life has prepared you for this. And I said to her, if I can do this, I know that at the end of, you know, then I will be fearless. So I've been voluntarily homeless now 2 years, and I've driven, just this year alone, I've driven 37,000 miles, and I couldn't drive even more than 10 miles 3 years ago.
Wow.
Yeah.
The question I'd love for you to answer is, I mean, I say it quite often when people say, what's the first step to becoming paleo or changing your life? And I always say, well, it's self-love. And that might sound a little bit corny, but like yourself, over the last 25 years, I've also participated in voluntary therapy sessions with different practitioners from all different walks of life, and to help me understand who I am, or to peel away the layers of fear or disempowerment or these negative emotions that actually make up who we are. And it's about getting back to the core truth of your authentic self. And I'd love your take on how you would talk to a listener about empowerment and also self-love, because we've talked about fear now, and I think we need to bring in a positive side of this and some of your tips and tricks that have worked for you and for others that you have seen.
Well, I love that you say that, Pete, about self-love, because to me that is, you know, moving your body. For me, my journey of healing was I moved my body first. Because I told you I was trying to beat MS out of me. So I moved my body, but I didn't like myself. So when I locked myself in the house, that was the beginning of my self-love journey. And I believe that conscious eating, whether it be paleo or however conscious you're going to define your conscious eating, the way to success is motivated by self-love, because any other start to a conscious eating food journey, usually if it's not motivated by self-love, it's going to feel like deprivation. So, and then failure usually happens with deprivation. So I believe that self-love is truly motivating. And for me, how I went from not liking myself to self-love was, I call all my tools of empowerment, my bag of tricks, was first I had to fake it till I make it. Like I had to act like I loved myself, even though I didn't, which, you know, one of my tips and tricks is, and I still do it to this day, I look in the mirror and I have conversations with myself. And, you know, I say, you know, I affirm and I say self-empowering things to myself. Like, I just got a van yesterday. Now, I used to drive around in a red Fiat, and now I have a huge van. And so many people on social media were like, are you going to be able to drive that? Are you nervous? How are you going to do it? And, you know, that made me a little worrisome. And I was like, well, I believe I can do it. Like, I wasn't worried about me being able to drive it. Why is everybody else worried about it? So for a week, when I knew I was getting the van, I had to look in the mirror and talk to myself. You can do this, V. You have this. There's nothing to be afraid of. Don't let other people's concerns define your journey. You know, all of these things. And I still have to do that. And, you know, that is a very powerful thing. You know, movement for me, yoga for me, and grounding and all of these things, believe it or not, they help my self-love journey, because I am taking time to move my body and honor my body and pay tribute to my body for all that it affords me, because I get to move my body freely. And that's a gift. And, you know, I find that as, you know, a tip and trick to self-love. Dancing and spending time in nature. All of these things are things that helped me to learn to love myself, because I before thought that love was defined by possessions, by how big my house was. And, you know, I was the girl that wore the gold Rolex and had diamonds and several homes and 6 cars and live in help. Like, I had all that and I was miserable. So I had to redefine what was important to me and what self-love looked like. And for me, self-love doesn't involve anything to do with possessions. And it involves nature and family and community and self-respect. And none of these things were in the forefront of my mind. Like, nature was, I mean, yeah, I knew when the seasons changed when I lived on the East Coast, but I didn't make it a point to spend time in nature. So these things, although you wouldn't think that that would help self-love, they truly do, because I make sure I take time to be outside in nature, because I know that my body loves that and my mentals love that, and I'm worth it. I'm worth it, you know? And I think that that is another thing that, you know, especially being raised an Italian female, we are raised that under the assumption that we are nurturers and we are to give until to everyone. And then when everyone is satisfied, then we get to take care of ourselves. And I've had to turn that upside down. I can't take care of anyone until I can take care of me first. And that is very powerful change in thinking for me. And I think for a lot of people, especially when you're a parent, I mean, you know, you have two daughters and, you know, to want to help your kids is of course what we want to do. But in order for me to be a good parent, I have to help myself first. And I didn't really understand that in the beginning. And I had to learn that behavior. And now my daughter was recently, not recently, but in the last several years was asked, what makes you the most proud about your mom? And her response floored me. And she said, she finally takes care of herself first.
That's beautiful.
And I was I was surprised.
You just touched on it then, and I think it's deep-rooted in so many different people. Cultural or societal upbringing, that identity to where a family has come from, what their belief systems are. For instance, you said you've got an Italian background and the role of the female in that was to give selflessly to others and to put themselves last is what I'm gathering. And a lot of people that I've met over the years will say, well, and we'll just use paleo as an example. Yeah, I'm from India and we eat a lot of rice, or I'm from Italy and we eat a lot of pasta. I'm from France and, you know, I couldn't imagine not having my bread and butter in the morning or a croissant. And I find it fascinating that people identify with the country or the culture they come from, instead of first and foremost identifying themselves as a unique and wonderful individual or human that is having this experience. So, I mean, I'm not sure whether you knew that this podcast was going to go this way, and neither did I, but I think this is probably linked back to fear and love and identity. So let's talk about that if you can, because these are some of the things you would have had to, I guess, evolve with or understand or let go of. And I'm sure there's so much wound up in this.
Oh, yeah. I mean, actually, I did a TED talk called Cultural Collision, because the funniest thing was when I had a physical therapist at the time who had been diagnosed with celiac. And at this time, I was so sick and nothing was working. And she said to me, you know, I just gave up gluten. And this was even before Dr. Walls. She's like, I just gave up gluten and it's helping so many things other than my stomach. Maybe you should give up gluten. So I was like, so desperate, I would have done anything. I'm like, okay. So I gave up gluten and I decided I should see a nutritionist. So I go to the nutritionist and she's like, well, that's great, you're giving up gluten, but you need to give up peppers, tomatoes, and eggplants because they're high inflammatory vegetables. And I looked at her and I was like, what? I mean, that's all I eat. I'm Italian. I mean, I don't even have a recipe that doesn't include those things. And she was like, well, that's kind of what you need to do. So, you know, I was dumbfounded. I didn't even know for a second how I was going to navigate this, but I also knew that I was running out of options. So I came back and I told my family, like, I'm giving up gluten, peppers, tomatoes, and eggplant. And my family's like, what? And they're like, well, not on Sunday, because Italians eat a big meal on Sunday, like as a whole family. And I'm like, no, like for the rest of my life. And they were like, no, but on holidays, you're going to eat on a holiday. I'm like, no, like I can't, and I'm not going to have cheese. Like I can't, you know, it evolved to like, I wasn't going to eat any of that. And they weren't very supportive in the beginning. And it actually made me feel really bad, because, you know, you often think that if you find out you have cancer or disease, like your family's going to be there. And I have a very loving family, but the reality is that a lot of times if your disease or sickness makes people uncomfortable, they're not always there. And I'm thinking, wow, this is going to separate me from my family because I can't eat the foods that we eat, but food is such a part of our culture. And, you know, I was devastated because I didn't really know how to navigate this. So I literally went to Italy and I took all my, you know, my grandmother had a file box with index cards. I took all those index cards with the family's recipes and went to Italy and recreated all those recipes paleo so that I could now come back to my family. And I made a little ebook that I could now come back to my family and be like, okay, I can't eat it the way we have it traditionally, but I come up with another version that for the holidays, we can have the traditional version and maybe this version on the other side. And that was the first step in my family realizing that I valued our culture and I wasn't trying to be difficult, which is what they saw, which is so funny that people think that when you're trying to change the way you eat, you're just trying to be difficult. They saw it as like a wake up call. Like, okay, even though when we look at V, we can't really see all that she's dealing with, but if she went all the way to Italy and recreated all these recipes and then made a book, like this is really important to her. And that for my family was the beginning of them understanding that my journey to healing was going to be about consciousness of living and that I was going to butt up against my culture. So for me, you know, it involved, you know, marrying what was important to my culture, which is food and family, and letting them know that I was still going to sit at that table and I was still going to celebrate the holidays and eat for 5 hours. Cause I don't know if you've ever eaten at an Italian holiday or Sunday, but I'm sure you probably have. Yeah. Cause you toured Italy. What was it last year? I remember being so jealous when you were all over there. You know, we just eat like, yeah. I mean, a Sunday meal is like 5 or 6 hours. I mean, it literally is. And I was going to go toe to toe with them. And we still have situations where, you know, when Italians plate their food, then someone comes around with the Locatelli cheese and the grater. You want a little cheese, and everyone says yes, and I say no, and they're like, a little bit's not going to kill you, and I have to look at them and say it is going to kill me, and we all laugh about it. They're still going to ask me if I want cheese, and I still get to say no, and we agree to disagree, but I had to come up again. I had to face the realities and the effects of my culture on my autopilot life, and I did it in the most respectful way that I could and respectful to my body and respectful to my family. But that did mean that I had to stand up and I had to say, I cannot do this. I cannot have, you know, pizza every Friday night that we make from flour. Cause I mean, we have certain meals, certain days of the week in our family. Like, you know what you're having by the day of the week. I know it sounds crazy, but that's literally how I was raised. And you know, I don't eat any of it, like none of it.
Let's talk about where you're at right now. Are you the healthiest or the most abundant or the most powerful or the most miraculous you've ever been in your life at this point?
I literally am all of those things. And I mean, I have so much joy that I literally do Facebook lives where I'm like, I have extra joy. Just take my joy. I can't believe I get to be me, every day. My health, when I first announced that I was going to become voluntarily homeless and live life on the road, I got two phone calls. One was from Dr. Terry Walls and one was from my friend, Dr. Will Cole. And they were both very concerned and they were like, how are you going to do this? You've done so well. You know, you're still early in the game. How are you going to do this? And I listened to what they said, and I am a type A overachiever and I am a boss. And in August, when I went to my naturopath for my yearly blood work, because I have MS, Epstein-Barr virus, Hashimoto's, I probably have Lyme disease as well. And I also have adrenal issues. And when I had my blood drawn in August of this year, I'm the healthiest I've been in my whole life. And that's after over a year of living on the road and voluntarily homeless and not having, you know, and at poverty. I mean, I'm a minimalist. I mean, I'm an extreme minimalist. and I feel like I actually have too much. Like, I mean, I can't wait to go to bed because I can't wait to wake up. And I open my eyes and I'm just filled with joy. And I go to bed filled with joy. And I have so much joy that, you know, I mean, now I travel around living with strangers. I mean, anyone that invites me to live with them, I live with them and open my bag of tricks. And I think that's the first thing that they realize is I am joyful every day. And my body is physically the best it's ever been. I mean, it literally is like It's so stellar. It's ridiculous. I mean, I'm more fit than a lot of people that don't have a disease. My body is better than a lot of people that I know that, you know, basically are what you would consider healthy. And I can run circles around them.
So anyone that's listening out there, just say they've changed their diet to be one of paleo or a low carb, healthy fat, or whatever definition label that's out there, which I don't like to use, but sometimes it helps to actually define a dietary approach. They've changed it. They're still feeling lethargic. They're still feeling they're under the weather. You and I both know that it's far greater than just the food that we put into our body, that we do have to take into consideration the beverages that we drink, the movement that we get, the breath, the breathing techniques or expansiveness of our lungs and connecting with nature and getting out and getting some vitamin D and actually taking some time for ourselves and sleep, as you've mentioned, and mindfulness. So where would you start with somebody to give them advice if you do give advice? And how would you, I guess, lay out a plan for somebody that will help them get to where they would like to go?
Well, I mean, regarding food, you know, let me erase that. The first thing is, again, you know, we spoke about that. I think that the first step is you have to really have an honest conversation with yourself and how much do you care about yourself? How much do you love yourself? And what is going to motivate these changes? And it can't be for your children, for your partner. It really has to be for you first and foremost. And although your children, your family, and your loved ones will benefit, your employer, whatever it is, you know, being motivated by wanting to live your best life is a number one. And, you know, I'm a biohacker at this point, which basically, you know, biohacking is sort of a new buzzword, but, you know, I am constantly testing the water. So, you know, am I, you know, strict paleo? Yes, I am. Meaning I don't eat outside of those guidelines, but I'm also, you know, I also follow a ketogenic lifestyle and I intermittent fast and I do 3-day fasting. And, you know, how did I get here is just constantly opening my eyes, looking, reading, you know, podcasts, blogs, Instagram, you know, using the computer, the power of the internet to educate myself and to be open to everything that's out there and be willing to consider, oh, how would this look for me? Whether it's, you know, you said, you know, I know labels aren't the best, but, oh, you know, would paleo work for me? And what would that look like? And what changes would I have to make? So engaging in honest conversation with yourself. And then for me, my greatest tool and the tool that I use the most with people is build your own logic model. Like ask yourself this question. If I got it right starting today, a year from now, what would life look like? And then answer that and then say, okay, what would have to change for that to happen? What would have to change right away? What resources do I have? What resources do I need? What activities are going to bring about this change? How am I going to measure my success? And really write it, you know, logic model out and just sort of play chess. You know, that's why I love the game of chess, because you're thinking so many moves ahead. So when you're thinking about making diet and lifestyle changes and tapping into your best life and stopping autopilot, before you even begin, have time, have an honest conversation with yourself. And the other thing I recommend is spend time doing nothing, because that's how I realized that the way I lived my life was toxic. I just spent 4 days with not meditating, because I wasn't in a meditative stance. I just wasn't focused on thoughts. I was focused on allowing myself to simply be. So if I was sitting, I was just sitting. If I was walking, I was walking. If I was breathing, I was, you know what I mean? I wasn't trying to meditate. I wasn't trying to be quiet. I was just trying to be completely present with whatever I was doing and no thoughts beyond that moment. And, you know, I think that these are powerful tools that, you know, can bring about desired change, if that makes sense.
I absolutely love it. Usually I wrap up a podcast by saying, what are some of your important or most delicious recipes for or ingredients for a recipe of life. And I think this whole podcast has been that. Is there anything you'd like to finish with today, V?
Just, you know, thank you so much for letting me share my story. And, you know, I truly believe that, you know, the miracle that I am is available to everyone. And the key is, you know, to love yourself enough to know that you're worthy of joy, of great health, and to also know that community is the ground in which I stand. I never walk alone. People like you, people, you know, inspire me every day. Your beautiful bride inspires me every day. Your kids inspire me every day with their fearlessness and their joy, and realizing that, you know, life is not, is, you know, we get to decide. We get to decide. Of course, there are environmental factors out there. Of course, there are things that may be out of our control, but how we live it is within our own choice. And I think we all should have joy if we want it.
Thank you so much, V. I just want to tell you that I love you, and our listeners obviously will love you as well once they've heard your beautiful words of wisdom. Have a beautiful time today, and we will connect soon. And our house is always open for you when you're traveling through Australia. So have a wonderful day, and we'll speak soon.
I love you too, Pete. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Namaste, my friend.
The information, views, and opinions expressed in this podcast should not be treated as a substitute for nutritional, medical, or other advice by a qualified professional. Guests in this podcast express their own opinions, experiences, and conclusions. Nothing in this podcast should be used to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any medical condition. Neither Pete Evans nor any sponsor endorse any views, opinions, or conclusions expressed or shared in this podcast.